diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
The following is a special CJSF presentation that interrupts regularly scheduled programming in this time slot.
Welcome to the Big Thinking Podcast, where we talk to leading researchers about their work on some of the most important and interesting questions of our time. I'm Gabriel Miller, and I'm the President and CEO of the Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences. Digital technologies are reshaping every aspect of our society, and books are no exception. But as physical objects, books have a powerful connection to us and our culture. As our world continues changing, it's worth asking what books mean to us and to our future. I'm joined by Claire Battersill, assistant professor cross-appointed in the Faculty of Information and the Department of English at the University of Toronto. You're a historian of books, among other things, but I want to start by asking you about your own history with books. When do you remember discovering your own love for books?
Oh, I love that question. So I grew up in Dawson Creek, BC, and that's a relatively small town. And one of the sort of places that a lot of kids used to go on the weekends or after school was the public library. And even before that, right, for circle time and all the activities that our wonderful public librarian, Jenny, used to run for us when we were little kids. And so the library, even when I was very tiny, was my favorite place in the world, the Dawson Creek Public Library. And my granddad used to take me there often, and there's actually a plaque for him in the reading corner where we used to read all the time. So it started very early, my interest in all this, and with a lot of encouragement from the library and from all of the wonderful programming that they ran and still continue to run for kids now, right? So it's a place that I think everybody really does often feel welcome and feels valued and honored, and I really sensed that very early in my life.
That's amazing. What's an early book you remember really enjoying?
I really loved and continue to love Goodnight Moon. And that book has a funny modernist history too. So it has a relationship now. There's been some really interesting work on Margaret Wise Brown and her connection to some of the ideas in modernist thinking. So if you think about, there's some weirdness in that book, right? It's like, you say goodnight to everything, and then you say goodnight nobody, right? So it has this kind of like strangeness that I think I always really liked. And it's one of those books that the whole visual of it, I think, has been in my mind for a really long time.
In addition to being a reader and a scholar of books, you've been an author yourself.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, what are some of the things you learned from writing books that you hadn't learned from reading them?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question to think about for me still, because I think that reading has always been felt very natural from my perspective. It feels like breathing. It comes very easily. It's one of those things that just feels, and it feels immersive. And it's not that escapist exactly, but it's very different than the work of writing, which never feels exactly easy. But it can feel, I think, like play or like experimentation. And I think that there's something about writing that I feel like I have to be just a tiny little bit brave whenever I'm doing it. Like I have to be ready to show up myself for something. And I think that only comes from the making side of things, and it doesn't come so much from the receptive side. I think I do feel that way about academic writing too, that it's creative. I think there is a way in which academic writing, even though it's not creative in the sense of being fiction, it is an act of creating an interpretation or an argument and crafting a thing. And I think all of those metaphors that we use about stitching arguments together or weaving them, a lot of them come from that world of material craft. And so I do really love that process in a different way.
When we talk about creating books, I want to tap in for a moment into your expertise as a historian. And I think you actually teach a course on the history of books at U of T. About how long have human beings been reading and writing books?
There's an important aspect of that question to sort of address almost before you answer any kind of chronological part of it, just such an academic answer, sorry. But this idea of what a book actually is kind of foundational to that question. So yeah. A lot of people associate the idea of the book with the Western Codex, right, which is a thing with two boards and a spine and pages that opens in a certain kind of predictable fashion, right? And the history of text on substrate, which is to say some kind of writing on some kind of surface, is extremely old and global and has taken place for a very long time. And you can think as far back as drawings on cave walls as examples of that kind of text on substrate or pictograph on substrate kind of idea. So I think in some ways, like tracing the beginning is almost an impossibility if you have that capacious understanding of what a book actually is, which I think is something I do try and impress upon my students, right? That there is a history of, for example, letterpress printing that sort of has a mythological origin with Gutenberg and so on, but there were also wooden printing blocks in China much, much before that. So there's lots of different traditions that have used book-like or book adjacent objects for communication, I think really almost forever. I think that's almost the answer is that there is no one origin story and it's not a linear path. And I think it's also helpful in the history of the book, I think, to be suspicious of some of those origin stories as told linearly, because they're often actually products of fits and starts of innovation. And sometimes some new technology comes in, but then it doesn't totally replace the old one. And so the old one coexists with it for a while. And those kinds of stories of revolution are often a little overdetermined in their narrative, right? It's like, it's much more common for there to be a more complicated truth.
There's, I think, the simplistic idea that I've had is for hundreds of years, books really consisted entirely of people writing on paper or something like paper. And that at some point there was a real revolution, which we associate, or I associate most with the name Gutenberg, but as you say, has roots in other parts of the world as well and in other historical moments, which ushered in the possibility of books being shared with a much larger audience. What's the role of the letterpress in that? And maybe can you say a couple words about what a letterpress is?
Sure. So letterpress printing is it's a type of printing. Like there is, of course, like one set of transitions, which again is like a messy, stuttering sort of transition, but is this idea of moving from manuscript, which is often one handwritten copy of a text, into print, which is to say you can produce multiples of the text, which can circulate among many people. And there are, again, lots of different forms of printmaking with woodblocks and other items that similarly create multiples. So this idea of going from one copy of the text to many copies of the text is like one of those kind of transformations of communication that does happen at different moments in different places. So letterpress printing specifically is a practice that involves taking usually individual letters, which are called sorts in the language of this work, and lining them up together to make the words that you want, and then setting those into lines, and then setting those lines into the shape of the page, which is called a form, and then printing, inking them up, putting ink on the letters, and then printing them on paper using a printing press. And obviously letterpress in some way is descriptive, right? You're pressing the letters into the page using the printing press. But one of the things that is really interesting about this process is that it does involve each letter taking up a physical space, right, and having a physical presence and a body. So when you type on the keyboard, on your computer, the letters appear, and you're using the same key multiple times, and the letter might appear multiple times on the page. In letterpress printing, every E has to be a physical object that has an E on it, and you have to put that into the page. So there's a one-to-one relationship between the letter and the work itself. And that practice, like, it was the dominant form of printing throughout the 19th century. There were no other options for a certain amount of time before you get into all manner of innovations that happened in the 20th century, a little bit into the 20th century. And it was used really in lots of different kind of configurations and with different incremental advances on the technology. So there's one in the mid 20th century called the linotype, or the monotype is another option, where basically the option is to set the whole line at once using a keyboard, and the lead still comes down and makes the letters, but it's all done at once on a line, and then you set those. So that's like takes one step out of the work process. That was used into the 80s, and commercially these things are essentially used until there's something that supplants them for efficiency, right? So now, of course, most digital printing is done, or most printing is done digitally. Offset is another innovation that kind of is a lot faster and more expedient. Now, letterpress is something that we tend to use in historical context or also in artistic practice. So mm-hmm. it's been really revived by artists recently.
And I'm really interested in hearing a little bit more about that, because the easy way to think of this is these are museum pieces now, and that their days of disrupting or revolutionizing our society are well past. But artists, are, among others, are using these, I don't know, established or older technologies in ways that can challenge us today. How are they doing that?
It's been really interesting to observe, even in the sort of decade or so that I've been working on this kind of stuff, the real flourishing of this work, actually, in activist and artist circles. A good example is that...
Welcome to the Big Thinking Podcast, where we talk to leading researchers about their work on some of the most important and interesting questions of our time. I'm Gabriel Miller, and I'm the president and CEO of the Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences. Digital technologies are reshaping every aspect of our society, and books are no exception. But as physical objects, books have a powerful connection to us and our culture. As our world continues changing, it's worth asking what books mean to us and to our future. I'm joined by Claire Battersill, assistant professor, cross-appointed in the Faculty of Information and the Department of English at the University of Toronto. You're a historian of books, among other things, but I want to start by asking you about your own history with books. When do you remember discovering your own love for books?
Oh, I love that question. So I grew up in Dawson Creek, BC, and that's a relatively small town. And one of the sort of places that a lot of kids used to go on the weekends or after school is the public library. And even before that, right, for circle time and all the activities that our wonderful public librarian, Jenny, used to run for us when we were little kids. And so the library, even when I was very tiny, was my favorite place in the world, the Dawson Creek Public Library. And my granddad used to take me there often, and there's actually a plaque for him in the reading corner where we used to read all the time. So it's a very, it's like, it started very early, my interest in this, and with a lot of encouragement from the library and from all of the wonderful programming that they ran and still continue to run for kids now, right? So it's a place that I think everybody really does often feel welcome and feels valued and honored, and I really sensed that very early in my life.
That's amazing. What's an early book you remember really enjoying?
I really loved and continue to love Goodnight Moon. And that book has a funny modernist history, too. So it has a relationship now. There's been some really interesting work on Margaret Wise Brown and her connection to some of the ideas in modernist thinking. So if you think about, there's some weirdness in that book, right? It's like, you say goodnight to everything, and then you say goodnight nobody, right? So it has this kind of like strangeness that I think I always really liked. And it's one of those books that the whole visual of it, I think, is has been in my mind for a really long time.
In addition to being a reader and a scholar of books, you've been an author yourself.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, what are some of the things you learned from writing books that you hadn't learned from reading them?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question to think about for me still, because I think that reading has always been felt very natural from my perspective. It feels like breathing. It comes very easily. It's one of those things that just feels, and it feels immersive. And it's not that escapist exactly, but it's very different than the work of writing, which never feels exactly easy. But it can feel, I think, like play or like experimentation. And I think that there's something about writing that I feel like I have to be just a tiny little bit brave whenever I'm doing it. Like I have to be ready to show up myself for something. And I think that only comes from the making side of things, and it doesn't come so much from the receptive side. I think I do feel that way about academic writing too, that it's creative. I think there is a way in which academic writing, even though it's not creative in the sense of being fiction, it is an act of creating an interpretation or an argument and crafting a thing. And I think all of those metaphors that we use about stitching arguments together or weaving them, a lot of them come from that world of material craft. And so I do really love that process in a different way.
When we talk about creating books, I want to tap in for a moment into your expertise as a historian. And I think you actually teach a course on the history of books of U of T. About how long have human beings been reading and writing books?
There's an important aspect of that question to sort of address almost before you answer any kind of chronological part of it, which is such an academic answer, sorry. But this idea of what a book actually is kind of foundational to that question. So yeah. A lot of people associate the idea of the book with the Western Codex, right, which is a thing with two boards and a spine and pages that opens in a certain kind of predictable fashion, right? And the history of text on substrate, which is to say some kind of writing on some kind of surface, is extremely old and global and has taken place for a very long time. And you can think as far back as drawings on cave walls as examples of that kind of text on substrate or pictograph on substrate kind of idea. So I think in some ways, like tracing the beginning is almost an impossibility if you have that capacious understanding of what a book actually is, which I think is something I do try and impress upon my students, right? That there is a history of, for example, letterpress printing that sort of has a mythological origin with Gutenberg and so on, but there were also wooden printing blocks in China much, much before that. So there's lots of different traditions that have used book-like or book adjacent objects for communication, I think really almost forever. I think that's almost the answer is that there is no one origin story and it's not a linear path. And I think it's also helpful in the history of the book, I think, to be suspicious of some of those origin stories as told linearly, because they're often actually products of fits and starts of innovation. And sometimes some new technology comes in, but then it doesn't totally replace the old one. And so the old one coexists with it for a while. And those kinds of stories of revolution are often a little overdetermined in their narrative, right? It's like, it's much more common for there to be a more complicated truth.
There's, I think, the simplistic idea that I've had is for hundreds of years, books really consisted entirely of people writing on paper or something like paper. And that at some point there was a real revolution, which we associate, or I associate most with the name Gutenberg, but as you say, has roots in other parts of the world as well and in other historical moments, which ushered in the possibility of books being shared with a much larger audience. What's the role of the letterpress in that? And maybe can you say a couple words about what a letterpress is?
Sure. So letterpress printing is a type of printing. Like there is, of course, like one set of transitions, which again is like a messy, stuttering sort of transition, but is this idea of moving from manuscript, which is often one handwritten copy of a text, into print, which is to say you can produce multiples of the text, which can circulate among many people. And there are, again, lots of different forms of printmaking with woodblocks and other items that similarly create multiples. So this idea of going from one copy of the text to many copies of the text is like one of those kind of transformations of communication that does happen at different moments in different places. So letterpress printing specifically is a practice that involves taking usually individual letters, which are called sorts in the language of this work, and lining them up together to make the words that you want, and then setting those into lines, and then setting those lines into the shape of the page, which is called a form, and then printing, inking them up, putting ink on the letters, and then printing them on paper using a printing press. And obviously letterpress in some way is descriptive, right? You're pressing the letters into the page using the printing press. But one of the things that is really interesting about this process is that it does involve each letter taking up a physical space, right, and having a physical presence and a body. So when you type on the keyboard on your computer, the letters appear, and you're using the same key multiple times, and the letter might appear multiple times on the page. In letterpress printing, every E has to be a physical object that has an E on it, and you have to put that into the page. So there's a one-to-one relationship between the letter and the work itself. And that practice, like, it was the dominant form of printing throughout the 19th century. There were no other options for a certain amount of time before you get into all manner of innovations that happened in the 20th century, a little bit into the 20th century. And it was used really in lots of different kind of configurations and with different incremental advances on the technology. So there's one in the mid 20th century called the linotype, or the monotype is another option, where basically The option is to set the whole line at once using a keyboard, and the lead still comes down and makes the letters, but it's all done at once on a line, and then you set those. So that's like a takes one step out of the work process. That was used into the 80s, and commercially, these things are essentially used until there's something that supplants them for efficiency, right? So now, of course, most digital printing is done, or most printing is done digitally. Offset is another innovation that kind of is a lot faster and more expedient. Now, letterpress is something that we tend to use in historical context or also in artistic practice. So it's been really revived by artists recently.
And I'm really interested in hearing a little bit more about that, because the easy way to think of this is these are museum pieces now, and that their days of disrupting or revolutionizing our society are well past. But artists are, among others, are using these, I don't know, established or older technologies in ways that can challenge us today. How are they doing that?
It's been really interesting to observe, even in the sort of decade or so that I've been working on this kind of stuff, the real flourishing of this work, actually, in activist and artist circles. A good example is that letterpress, a lot of large 19th century wood types, which were used for posters and advertisements and things like that, they really make excellent protest posters, those typefaces. They work really well because they're very large and visible, and they have this kind of distinctive aesthetic that seems to carry a certain visual appeal, right? So people use them for that purpose and to support all different kinds of activist causes. And that's been a kind of real reactivation of the medium. The idea of the museum pieces, which I want to return to just for a minute, it's like, it's a delicate dance, I think, sometimes for those of us who work with these materials, because we do use 19th century presses and we use 19th century wood type and metal type. And so they are historical artifacts which need a certain amount of conservation, and in different climate conditions and other things like that, it impacts the wooden objects, and you have to be careful about how you approach that. So there's the balance of the need for conservation and care, and then also the idea that, like, if you're really going to preserve them, you also want to preserve their use, right? You want to preserve them as the things that they actually were intended to be, which is vehicles for communication, right? They were designed for people to share their poems or their protest ideas. So to my mind, like, a full museum practice around letterpress involves also ensuring that they're fit for use. And so that's been something that we've worked on a lot with the collection, various different collections that I've been part of, is just making sure that the materials are available to people to share their own new ideas. I think that's how they maintain relevance and don't become display objects, which they were never intended to be, right?
But part of what you've said is, as I understand it, is no, there's an aesthetic experience in interacting with a book that goes beyond something that can't be reduced to quote unquote data, and that... Yeah. It challenges this idea that a book shouldn't be judged by its cover, or that a cover of a book doesn't tell you anything important about that.
There's a really interesting way of putting it that Leonard Wolf had in his autobiography, where he talked about the material outside of a book and the immaterial inside. And that's a metaphor, right? There's the outside-inside thing is a little complicated, but there, I do believe in the idea that there is a material existence of a book and also a conceptual kind of experience deriving from the language. But I think that both of those play into experiences of reading. And I also think that e-books have a materiality. Your Kobo is a material artifact with which you have a relationship, however hard or not hard you think about that. Our phones have a materiality that we also engage with every day, all the time, that our thumbs get used to and that we have this kind of tactile experience with. And so I think this has always struck me as something that's really interesting that happens in academia, is that sometimes the ideas take precedence over the embodied experience. And a lot of scholars who are in some way thinking about feminist or queer approaches really do question that kind of like separation of embodiment and thinking, because thinking is actually an embodied process, right? Like neuroscientists will tell you that too. So it seems to me very important to continually reiterate those kind of complex connections and entanglements that exist between material experience and cognition or thinking.
Is that the sort of example that illustrates how using feminist or critical methodologies are informing your approach to the study of book history, that allows you, gives you conceptual tools to challenge those sorts of assumptions?
I think so. And I think in some ways, part of it is foregrounding the embodied elements of the work that we already do. It's noticing the things that maybe have been gone unremarked in the practices that we have, and or even maybe just amping it up a little bit. So an example is that when you do sort of book historical work, you do often examine physical copies and special collections. That's long been the case with this discipline. There's a long history of people looking at many copies of the same text, for example, to try and figure out the variances and to try and learn what they call the ideal text might be. But that too is an embodied practice. And so when I teach my students about these kinds of experiences, I try and do it in a way that incorporates their own kind of like physical making activities into their historical experiences. So if we're going to learn about historical bookbindings, we might also try that style of bookbinding, like using a needle and thread and try out making it ourselves just to see what that actually feels like, because that kind of embodied learning does also reinforce the embodiment of the processes that went into the making of the book in the first place, right? Those are the parts of history that sometimes are harder to document, right? Because they don't survive in the record in any way, the movement of people's hands or those kinds of things. So yeah, I think that the feminist approaches that I take largely have to do with trying to speak into silences a little bit, mm-hmm. and trying to open up those spaces where maybe we know that there was a person or a body, but it's not really articulated, and trying to make that articulation, and also to kind of like foreground those elements of embodiment and also feeling that you have in the archive and in the library.
Because so I have to ask you about this, because my own undergrad was woefully lacking in hands-on creation. So let me ask you, when you say that some of what your students do is make to learn, these are students in your history of books class?
I do it everywhere. I'm kind of like, I'm a little notorious about the suitcases that I roll around campus with all sorts of materials. I mean, book history for sure. I also am currently teaching a creative writing class that is about making chapbooks. And so the students are writing their own texts and they're also making their own books. So they're going to circulate together in their class. So I bring it into a lot of things. Even in my culture and technology class at the high school, I have them make zines and stuff like that. Like I try and do it as much as possible, to be honest, because I think it is defamiliarizing still. I think for a lot of, and there's more of it happening in different maker spaces and other mm-hmm. innovations, like for sure. And I find the iSchool at Toronto, which is the information faculty where I'm partly appointed, is very pro embodied learning and other kinds of making. There are lots of us doing that kind of work, but it's still for a lot of undergraduate students in traditional humanities or science programs, it's not a huge part of their academic life, these kinds of hands-on activities, but they really love them. And I think they sort of learn differently from them. And I also think it kind of makes them nervous in this interesting way. It's, I think, a helpful nervousness that says, this is something new that I don't know how to do. And then coming out the other side of that and realizing that you can try and experiment, in some ways it goes back to the Virginia Woolf thing, right? Like the book might not look beautiful the first time you make one, but there's a value in doing it that kind of goes beyond that what you might think that you might learn about things by doing it.
And it seems to me, there's a lot of hands-on knowledge in the work you're doing, learning how to bind a book, but also when it comes to the issues around digitization, you haven't just been studying these in the abstract. You've been using digital tools for your work. And I'm thinking specifically about the modern.
This is Bird Note. What's the most colorful bird in the U.S.? The scarlet tanager? Maybe the painted bunting? Well, consider one more lustrous candidate, the purple gallinule. The purple gallinule's feathers are so iridescent that they might not seem real. The head, neck, and underparts are purple. Colors shade down the back from purple to indigo to azure to golden green. The forehead is blue, beak red, and legs yellow. Catching the sun, the entire bird shimmers. Despite its bold style, a purple gallinule can be hard to spot. The colors create excellent camouflage among the greens, blues, and floral highlights of a marsh. With lightweight bodies and extremely long toes, gallinules stride deftly atop water lilies and other vegetation, snatching up snails, insects, and plants of many kinds. The purple gallinule might sound impractical with its big feet and vivid colors, but find one in a marsh, and all the parts of this bizarre bird will suddenly make sense. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.